Welcome to week 36 of Job. We are in the 21st parak, the 21st chapter, and we have quite a bit to talk about. This is Job's response to Tzofar's second and last speech. So just, again, we're already in the middle of the chapter, but just to bring everybody up to speed, Tzofar had initially said to Job back in the first round that God's wisdom is great and hidden, it is broader than the earth, it is deeper than the sea, or longer than the earth and broader than the sea, something along those lines, and that therefore one cannot question the wisdom of God. You should repent and approach God and then everything will be wonderful. And Job had responded by saying, God is the greatest indeed. He is the greatest source of destruction. And he said, I am the righteous one. I am the true view of what God is and what God does. And no one else actually really grasps what is going on. He lays out his case against God, or not no one else grasps it, but no one presents it. No one is willing to speak the truth. And then Tzofar responded in chapter 20 with a personal attack. Less philosophical, more personal, less positive, more negative. And he said, the wicked bring everything down upon themselves with their appetites, and they suffer, and their children suffer, and Job, that's why you are suffering. He alleged directly that this is all Job's fault. And Job began his response by saying, and we read the opening six lines of the parak of the chapter, if you're using the stone Tanakh, the art scroll one, it's on page 1647. Job, Eov, said, I'm about to shock you. That's it. He said, prepare to be shocked by what I have to say. And that brings us to what he believes is going to shock the listener. We started it a little bit last time, but it's the section that is Perachaf Aleph Psukim Zayin to Tet Zayin, chapter 21, sentences 7 to 16. In which Job says, the wicked are not punished. As simple as that. Whereas every speaker in round 2 said to him, Eliphaz, Bildad, Tzofar, all of them said, wicked people suffer, and the implication was, Job is suffering, therefore he must be wicked. His response here is, forget it, it's not so. That's his reply. We read, I believe, Malbim in source number 1 with his statement along these lines that Eliphaz said the wicked live in fear. He says, no, they don't. They're happy and they're secure. And Bildad said that their line is cut off. They don't have descendants. No, that's not true either. Their line does just fine. And the last bit that we did was this piece from Newsom in source number 2. Which I included here on the sheet for this week as well, because this week we're actually going to see it play out. The point that she made in source number 2 is that what Eov is going to do, what Job is going to do in this section, starts out as the same as what we find in Tehillim, in Psalms. We find repeatedly within Psalms that King David will turn to God and say, why do you allow this? And the wicked are thriving, and they're doing well, and they're having this, and they're having that. And Job sounds like he's going to do the same thing, except that he's going to make a left turn. And after he has lured us into thinking that we're going to see what happens in Tehillim, in Psalms, which is that after you read this sequence of allegations, then what we find after that is either turning to God and saying, God, please make this right, or coming up with justifications for why God allows this to be so, Job is going to end the story differently. And that's how he's going to turn what we usually see in Tehillim, in Psalms, on its head. So let's look at the psukim. Let's look at the verses themselves. Again, we're at 21:7 in the green Tanakh. You're looking at page 1646, 1647. Everyone have it? There were source sheets. I think I see a couple over here if anyone needs. There's one more over there. If anyone is not getting the source sheets, please make sure to see me after class. Make sure to give me your email address so that you will receive them, hopefully. Okay. So, again, he begins with verse 7, sentence 7, saying, Madua Rishayim Yechiu, why do the wicked live? Asku. Ayin Tav Kuf Vav implies strength. Atak is something that is strong, that is powerful. Atku, they become strong. Gam Gavru Chayel, they amass wealth and strength. chayil in general in Tanakh is a reference not to valor. Eshet chayil, woman of valor, is very poetic, but it's not the translation. Chayil, generally speaking, refers to wealth or strength. That's usually the term. If you think of the judges Moshe appoints as anshei chayil, and so on, I mean, over and over again in Tanakh. So how is it that these people could be so well off? And now he describes the ways that they thrive. And you will see very quickly, he has one particular point in terms of the way that the wicked thrive. By the way, if the urn noise is bothering anybody, I'm fine with turning it off, but it's up to people who are here. I'm not having hot water, so... what do I care? it's up to you. But if the noise is bothering people, I wouldn't want them distracted by it. Okay, sentence 8. Zar'am nachon lifnehem imam v'tzeetzaehem le'enehem. Their seed, their children, are all arranged beautifully before them. Their grandchildren, tzeetzaehem, their descendants, before their eyes. Batehem shalom mipachad. Their houses are at peace. There is no fear. And again, that's the response to Bildad, who had said that they live in fear. He says, no, was it Eliphaz who said they live in fear? No, they don't. Velo shevet aloka alehem, the rod of God, the rod that would strike, that would punish, is not upon them. Shoro ibar velo yagil, their ox becomes pregnant, and it does not lose the pregnancy. Hag'alah. What is Hag'alah? Sorry?
Want to invent something?
Close. I mean, that's the process by which we produce Hag'alah. Hag'alah is to spit something out. Right? In kashrut, when we kashrut something, we may use a process of Hag'alah in which we boil it up in order to cause whatever was not kosher that was absorbed in the walls to exude from the walls. That's what we're talking about. And here he's saying the ox becomes pregnant, and below Yagil, it doesn't lose the pregnancy. Tifalet paraso, the cow will produce young. Velo sishakel, and it will never lose them. Yishalachu chatzon avi lehem, they will send forth their young like sheep. For those who have good memories, remember we have to go back to last spring for this one. But in chapter 19, sentence 18, we saw the problematic verse. Was it 1918? You don't really have to go back to it. But I like it because it vindicates what I said at the time. In that chapter, in 19, it was Job speaking, responding to Bildad, and he's talking about how everyone has abandoned him. And in sentence 18, he said, "Gam avilim ma'asuvi, even avilim reject me." And I felt in context it had to be referring to family, even though usually ayin vav lamed is a term for someone who is wicked, avel. And so you could render it as wicked people, but it really didn't seem to fit. It fit more as young. Well, lo and behold, when you get here, sentence 11, it's very clear he's talking about young and using that term avilehem. So the term can be used and is used, in fact, in Job, to refer to young. Yishalachu chatzon avilehem, back in our sentence, chapter 21, 11. They send forth their young like sheep, vialadehem yirakedun, and their youths, their children, will go dancing. Everything is wonderful for them. That's what he describes. He's not done. He's going to continue. But what's the theme in these last four sentences in describing how the wicked are doing well? What is the key for him?
Their kids survive,
and
they don't get killed off.
Right. Their kids are wonderful. Their kids are thriving. Why is this his emphasis? In response to Tzofar. Because Tzofar said the loss of his children demonstrates that he is wicked. He says, I have news for you. I've seen plenty of wicked people, and their kids are doing just fine. Yes?
But it's also in conjunction with the flock. Basically, life goes on,
or the weakest, and for the possessions as well.
And for the possessions too. It's actually, the way I look at it, it's 8 and 9 are about the kids being fine and having no fear, and 10 and 11 are about the animals being fine and having no fear. Yerakedun, they're out dancing. So yes, absolutely, it's the parallel is there, and it continues in sentence 12. Yisu kisov v'chinor v'yismechu lekol ugav. Yisu literally is to raise up, but it's a term we often use with music. Dan Mikra points out se'u zimra, right? To raise up a song. Se'u zimra usnu tov kinor ne'im nabil. So he says they raise up like the drum. The kinor, the stringed instrument, yismechu lekol ugav, they rejoice by the sound of the drum. Yivalu v'tov yimehem, they wear out their days in goodness. Everything is wonderful in bounty. Uberega sho'ol yechatu, and in an instant, they descend to the depths. What happened there? He just went negative?
No, they
die. They have
a happy life till the last minute.
They are happy to the end, and that's it. Then they disappear. It's not going negative at all. He's saying everybody has to go at some point, and they go in an instant without any suffering at all. That's the message that he's trying to convey, as opposed to his prolonged agony.
They go like the righteous go.
Should go.
Right, in this hypothetical world of justice that he doesn't live in. It's interesting because it shows the modern preference for death without suffering is not new. This isn't some kind of new phenomenon. It's what he believes is the ideal. The Talmud has a discussion as to what's the ideal and suggests that it's best if someone doesn't have some notice. They can put their affairs in order. So it says maybe 3 days, fine. That's the conclusion there. But Job says no. In an instant, that's what he would like to see. And so he continues. Pasuk Yudalet, sentence 14. Vayomru lakel sur mimenu. They say to God, go away. V'das derechecha lo chafatznu. We don't need to know your ways. Pasuk Tetzvav, sentence 15. Masha kai kinav denu. What is this God you speak of? That we should worship him. Umano il kinifgava. What benefit will he provide if we were to pray? Nifga pe gimel ayin is a term meaning an encounter, but it's often used specifically for prayer. If you think of Vayivgaba Makom with Yaakov, that's one example where we talk about it. Pigia is often used to refer to tefillah, to prayer. Hein lo viadam tuvam. He says, and this concludes his section, and there are a few different ways to translate this line. I'm going to translate it one way right now. Hein lo biadam tuvam, atzas v'shoim rachakameni. He says, it's not that they have produced the good that they enjoy. The bounty they have is not biadam. It's not coming about from their hand, and therefore, what they believe, their ideas, when they think that they've created their wealth themselves, that's distant from me. I can't accept what these wicked people are saying. Art Scroll here has a different translation, as does Rashi, as does Mitzudat Zion, Mitzudat David. Ibn Ezra has yet another way to read it, but I'm going with this read, which is the Dat Mikra's read, as we've noted any number of times, there are always, in Eov, there is never one way to read a sentence. There's no such thing. And at a certain point, you just have to cut bait. But this is his response to Tzofar, that wicked people do well. If you take a look at source number 3, I thought this was interesting. Passage from the Talmud regarding Dora Mabul, the generation of the flood. It takes this passage from Eov, from Job, and applies it to them. The way we got into this mess of learning Job was because we spent a year doing the Medrash on the story of Noach, on Bereshit Rabbah, and we noted how many times the Medrash draws on passages from Eov, from Job, and applies it to Noach, and applies it to his generation. Bereshit Rabbah in general likes to draw on Eov, on Job, but you sort of wonder if it doesn't also, because of the possibility that Job is not Jewish, and Noach, we know, is not Jewish, and therefore there may be associations that could be made. Okay, but take a look at source number 3, where it says, the generation of the flood were arrogant only because of the good God bestowed upon them. He flowed upon them. And what does it say regarding them? And it takes the verse that we have here from Eo, from Job. Their houses are at peace from fear. The rod of God is not upon them. And it goes on. I didn't bring every verse from our chapter as they apply it. Amrub, they said, all we need from him is a drop of rain. Right? Is that all we need God for? Is to provide rain? We're good. We have rivers. We have springs. Right, I must have told the scientist thing here at some point, right? The scientists and their showdown with God about creating life. That didn't come up in this class ever? Oh, good opportunity to retell it. The scientists wanted to have a showdown. They discovered that they had a way to create life in a laboratory. And they said, we're going to show. We don't need God anymore. We can do it just as well as God does. We're going to challenge him to see who can do it better even. And so they say, God, we're going to have this meeting and we'll bring our materials. And God says, okay, fine. He shows up. And they start unpacking their various chemicals and their dirt. And God says, no. You have to bring your own dirt. So, that's what's going on here, right? The Gemara is saying it. They say that we don't need God for rain because we have springs and rivers. Like, who gave you the springs and rivers? You didn't make those. So, God replies to them here, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Betova Sheishpati Lahen, Boh Machisinosi. The good that I gave them, the bounty I bestowed upon them, that's what they're using to anger me. Ubah Anidanosam. I'm going to use that when I punish them. And it quotes the line, Va'ani Hinini Mevias Hamabul Mayim, I, behold, I am bringing the flood of water. And what this midrash here is picking up on is, number one, the word vani in the beginning of the sentence, and I, as opposed to them. It's God saying, they did something, and this is my response to what they are doing. And the fact that God specifies that it's going to be a flood of water. Why water? Because water is the bounty that he bestows upon them, and they start to take for granted. And God says, that's what I'm going to use. That's what I'm going to use against them. So that's what Job here is saying is the trait of the wicked. They think they have everything and that they don't need God at all. Okay. Interestingly, Malbim notes, so far also described the wicked as being cut off suddenly. If you were to go back to chapter 20, sentences 7 to 9, so far, describe them, you don't have to read it there right now, but just, that's where it is. So far, also describe them being cut off suddenly as a negative. But Job actually considers it a positive. So, Job says, I disagree with them. What he's really saying is, I think, he's reasserting what he told so far last time, which is, I am pious. I am the righteous one. Right? That was what he had said to him in the first go-around. In the first round, he's reiterating it. He's editorializing in the middle. He brought what the wicked say, and he says, but that's not what I believe. I believe God is mighty. I just don't think he runs the world with justice. But I am absolutely the one who is loyal to God. Again, this section would have been very at home in Tehillim. This would have been perfectly at home in Psalms. If you take a look in your Tanakh, you turn to Tehillim Perek Yud, Psalms chapter 10. Tehillim is not far before where we are right now. It's 1443, thank you. The bottom of the page, 1442-43. Look at what it says here. Sorry?
The citation is fine.
You have it on your sheet. You have it on your sheet in number 4. You see it? Psalms chapter 10, verses 1 to 11. Okay? So look at what he says. I'm just going to read it out quickly from the English, just to make sure everyone sees it. Why, Hashem, do you stand aloof? Do you conceal yourself in times of distress? In the wicked one's haughtiness, he hunts down the poor who are caught in the schemes they have contrived. Why do you stand aloof when the wicked man glories in his personal desire? The robber praises himself that he has blasphemed Hashem. The wicked man, in the pride of his countenance, says he will not avenge. All his schemes are, there is no divine judge. His, the wicked, his ways are always successful. Your judgments are far removed from him. He says in his heart, I shall not falter. His mouth is filled with false oaths, deception, malice. He waits in ambush near open cities. He says in his heart, I'm skipping. He says in his heart, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see. You could take what we just read in Job and put it like up to this, and it's the same thought. You follow? It's the same thought. Turn to chapter 73 in Psalms, please. It is page 1499. Chapter 73, sentences 4 to 16. Yep. He describes himself seeing the wicked, or as they translate it here, the roisterers, which is a word I never thought I would say. You see it? He says, there are no fetters to their death. Their vitality is sound. They are excluded from the toil of frail humans. They are not plagued as are other men. He's talking about the wicked. Therefore, arrogance is their necklace. Their violence wraps their hips with fat. Their eye bulges from fat. They have exceeded the fantasies of their heart. They consume and speak evilly about oppression. From on high do they speak. They say, they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, but they are always tranquil. They have attained great wealth. Right? The same argument. The same thing that we're talking about. The passage that calls on God and says, there are terrible people out there, and you seem to be doing nothing, and they know that you are doing nothing. But, as we said from Newsom last week, he's setting us up. Eob is setting us up in doing this, because this is not... He's not going to conclude the way that the Psalms conclude. Go back, please, to chapter 10. And we're going to read sentences 12 to 18 quickly. Page 14... Yeah. Page 1445. Yeah. Psalms chapter 10, where we just read the part that complains. Yeah. Look at sentences 12 to 18. Arise, O Hashem. O God, raise your hand. Do not forget the humble. Why does the wicked man blaspheme God? Because he says in his heart, you will not avenge. But you do see. For you observe mischief and vexation. To dispense punishment is in your power. The helpless rely upon you. The orphan, you are the helper. Break the power of the wicked and the bad one. You will search for his wickedness and find it not. Meaning you will have destroyed it. Hashem is king forever and ever. When the nations have perished from his earth. And so on. God, zap the people who are doing terrible things, destroy wickedness, and save the righteous and the vulnerable. Right? That's how he ends his complaint in chapter 10. Now jump ahead to chapter 73. I apologize for taking you back and forth, but I think you need to see it consistently. Both first the complaint, and then the way that he follows it up. So we're back on page 1499, sentences 17 to 28. He says, really starting with 16, I suppose, when I reflected to understand this, it was iniquity in my eyes. What I saw was terrible. Until I came to the sanctuaries of God, I contemplated their end, meaning the end of the wicked. Only on slippery places do you set them. You cast them down into destruction. How have they become desolate in an instant? They came to an end. They were consumed through bewildering terrors. Like a dream upon awakening. So the Lord in the city, you will render their appearance despicable. When my heart was in ferment, though my mind was sharpened, and I was senseless and unknowing, like mindless beasts was I with you. Still I was always with you. You grasped my right hand. You always supported me. May you guide me in your counsel, and afterwards you will take my soul unto you. Who else do I have in heaven? When I am with you, I do not desire anything on earth. He's describing how the wicked will be cast down, and God is going to take care of the righteous. Clear? I'm not sure. What we're seeing here is that in Tehillim, in Psalms, the statement is, wicked people suffer. They say God isn't even watching, and there's no justice in this world. And then he follows it up by turning to God and saying, but I know you're there. And I know that you're going to take care of the vulnerable. And I know that you're going to punish the people who abuse them. That's how he follows it up. And so imagine Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are sitting there in front of Job. And Job starts with a very Tehillim-like, a very Psalm-like statement of how he is sure that how the wicked are in fact thriving and doing well, and they say we don't need God. And you can picture his listeners thinking to themselves, oh, okay, he's seen the light. He's describing how upset he is about the wicked, and now he's going to do as we do, which is, he's going to say, and now God zaps the wicked. And he even says, I don't think like the wicked do. Which is such a tempting line to read as to read as a lead-in to say, I believe in God being good and punishing the wicked and so on. And that's not what he does. Are we clear on where we're going? Yeah.
It's not what he does? He doesn't?
Nope. Watch what's going to happen instead.
But let's see. That just gave me an insight into why we don't talk about the world to come. Because that's where the wicked will be punished.
Well,
we don't see the whole picture that God, Hashem, sees.
Right.
We only see a moment in time.
Careful, you sound like Zophar now. That's Zophar's line. Take a look at sentence 17, chapter 21, sentence 17. Okay, we're at the bottom of 1646, 1647. Debbie, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask you, he's talking about the wicked and what good comes in their life, but the only example he gives of them being wicked is that they're atheists.
I don't think so. I think he described them as being wicked just, sort of to start things out. And then he said they thrive. And in response to their thriving, they don't credit you, God. They say that it has nothing to do with you. But not that defines their wickedness. They started out as wicked in his opening sentence before they were thriving. Yeah. I don't think that that's necessarily it. It could be a part of it. It could be a part of it, but I don't think it's the sum. So what he then follows up with starts for us in sentence 17. And what he does is to say, I know all your answers for why it is that wicked people do well. I know all your theological justifications, and they're all wrong. That's his answer in a nutshell. And he's going to go through them one by one. He says, first of all, when you tell me that wicked people suffer, kama ner rishaim yid'ach v'yavo alemo edam. He says, I'm following the read of Mitzudat David. There are a lot of different ways to read this section, but we won't understand it if I go through all of them. Mitzudat David reads it as, how many times does it actually happen that the wicked are crushed? V'yavau aleimo edam, and their day comes for them. Chavalim yichalek be'apo, such that God is going to divide them up in portions, chavalim, or that cause them to suffer in his rage. Yiyu kiseven lifnei ruach, that they will be scattered like straw before the wind. Uchemot ginavatu sufa, or like chaff stolen away by the wind. That structure of ginavatu, for a word, is an interesting structure. The only places you find that besides Eov that I can think of is Rus. You find a similar type of a structure for a verb. But he says, you tell me the wicked suffer. I don't see too many people who are wicked actually suffering. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 6, you see I brought it from Mitzudat David. He says, Hine ra'isi rishayim rabim yivalu b'tov yimeihem. I see many wicked people wearing out their days in bounty, like we talked about a couple of verses ago. V'im yimatzu rishayim medu ka'im. If lowly wicked people are to be found, how many of them are there? It may be that there are wicked people who suffer, but it doesn't represent the whole. That's argument number one.
Luis. Job says he's not thinking like a wicked person?
Yep.
Where did he say that? He's going to say that.
Well, he said it back in sentence 16, the second half of sentence 16, meaning when the wicked say, God hasn't provided me with my goodness, I don't need God. I don't believe that that they are correct. And he continues then, having said, if wicked people suffer, that may happen, but it happens rarely. But then he continues to say, answering another point, one of the statements that had been made to him was that even if the wicked don't suffer, their children will suffer. He says, Eloka, sentence 19, Eloka yitzpon levanav ono. Let's say God will store away, yitzpon tzafun, hidden away, like at the Seder, right? We've seen this word before. God will hide away for his children, his oven, his corruption, that which he had done. Yishalem elav v'yeda. He says, what good is that? Let him pay it back to the wicked person. Let him know. What good does it do if his children are going to suffer? Yiru einav kido. Let his eyes, meaning the eye of the wicked person, see what's wrong. Let him see, I'm sorry, the punishment. Kido as a term for a weapon. Umechamas shaka yishta. Let him drink from the poison of God. You're going to see a different translation possibly in the art scroll. Don't get hung up on it. Because again, there are multiple ways to read this line. The Mitzudat David is very text-driven, and that's why I feel more comfortable going with what he has. But the statement fundamentally is the same. Whether you take individual clauses and turn them from questions into statements and that sort of thing, the statement is fundamentally the same. He is responding to the theological arguments that people bring to him. You say wicked people suffer, not in real numbers. You say that their children are going to suffer for it, what good is it? Why is that? Why is that helpful? He says, and he concludes that point with sentence 21. Ki machavso beveisa acharav. What does the wicked person care about what's happening after him? Umispar chadashav chutzatzu, and the number of his months. The umispar chadashav, is it actually his months or his new ones? The umispar chadashav, probably his new ones. No, chutzatzu will be cut off. The I'm just looking to see if Don Megra gives me anything, but I think it's his new ones. No, months. Oh, so it's after his months are cut off, whatever is going to happen after that. Okay, that's a good way to read it. So what he has said is, I don't care about your arguments about what's going to happen in the future. It's really not terribly relevant. And again, Mitzudat David, I brought you in source number 7. Vim b'mesha elokam atmin lebanav gemul avon hagezel sha'anas b'kocho. If God is going to store away for his children the payback for his sin of theft, right, Debbie, we wanted to know what he calls wicked. Theft is over and over again referred to as wicked within the book, and that's, I think, a more substantive basis for identifying wickedness in Eov. He says, if God is going to store away for his kids the punishment for the theft that this fellow took by force, then do it to him. And he will know that there's a judge in the land. He will know that God judges. And he continues now back in Job again, sentences 22 to 26. You say there is an order to things. There is no order. Halakel yelamed das vuhu ramim ishbot. And again, this is a sentence that admits multiple translations. Here they have it, I see in the art scroll, as can one teach knowledge to God, he who judges the lofty. The another way to take it is, will you teach knowledge on behalf of God to justify what God does? God as the one who judges up in the heavens. Zeyamus be'etzem tumo kulo shal hanan v'shalev. He says, this wicked person dies when he is complete, at the height of his completeness. He is entirely at peace. Atinav malu chalav, his udders are filled with milk. Umoachatz mosav yishukeh, the marrow in his bones is moist, as opposed to somebody who has suffered and dried up. Vizeyamus benefesh mara, whereas this other person dies with a bitter spirit. V'lo achal batova, he never had any bounty to eat. Yachad al afar yishkavu, they lie down in the dust together, v'rimat chaseh aleihem, and the worms will cover all of them. That's his response. So what Job has done is he's really kind of slapped, you know, his three visitors in the face. Because he set them up, beginning with this complaint about how the wicked do, and they expect he's going to call on God to punish them. But rather than call on God to punish them, he said, and I know all the justifications you're going to bring. You're going to tell me that wicked people suffer? No, they don't. You're going to tell me their children are punished? No, they're not. You're going to tell me there's some order of things, some big plan? No, there isn't. If you take a look back at source number 5, you see the way that Newsom phrases it. This is really her point. From verse 7 through verse 15 in chapter 21, but where he set them up, he says, Job's speech says nothing that will be out of place in the Psalms. And in a conventional psalm, verse 16 would serve as the beginning of the psalmist's reply to his own doubts. Here is the parody. Job pays homage, or homage, depending on how you say it, to the convention of implicit dialogue, but he turns it into a real one. Job's insistence on an accounting exposes what iconic narratives repress. That is, that they are the product of highly selective perception. The allegation is that people who see justice in the world are only looking at the sample they want to look at. That's Job's allegation. And remember that when we started round 2, and they began making their claims about the wicked being punished, we asked, do they really believe what they're saying? And one answer we gave was, it doesn't fit everything they see, but it's the narrative from which they view the world, and everything they see that fits it gets a check mark, and that which doesn't fit it is an anomaly that has to be explained. Right? Remember we gave the example of people believing that if you work hard in business, you'll succeed. And people say that, and they teach it to their children, even though we know plenty of cases in which people worked really hard, they did the right thing, and yet it crashed. It didn't work. How do we explain that? Why do we keep telling our children, if you work hard, you'll succeed? Because that's the basic narrative which we believe, which we would like to believe, quite frankly. It does fit certain things that we see, and anything that doesn't fit it, well, kasha, it's a problem. It needs to be addressed. That's the way they look at it. And Job's response to them is, that's not fair. He says, you're looking at a small sample and claiming to extrapolate the way the universe works. It's just not so, he says. I saw a couple of hands. Read them.
So the idea that God is not just, is that inconsistent with the Jewish view of God?
Yeah. Very inconsistent.
Yeah, we believe.
We don't like this.
We believe God is just.
Right.
Okay. So how do we answer Job's, you say it's in the next world? How do we answer his question?
We have 21 chapters to go.
But I say
I know exactly what we're saying, but we have 21 chapters to go. I figure if I could just wear everybody out, you know. Year 4. Yes? No. This is our second. We have 2 to go now.
Okay. Isn't it a little odd that someone is saying, so what's the difference if their sons are punished? The person doesn't care. But this is a person who's just had his sons killed.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, right? Job, on the one hand, is grieving for the loss of his children. And on the other hand, is saying, yeah, what does the wicked person care?
So.
Right. So I think one answer to it is the key of his presence. In other words, it's not that he doesn't care what happens to his kids, but after he's gone, he won't know from such things. And that's Job's assumption, is that in fact the wicked person won't know of such things once he's gone. So I think that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is, I think this is really very characteristic of people who are angry and miserable, which is they will make contradictory points. They're good with that idea. Susan and then Stephen.
Can it also be that Job says, I'm not wicked. I do care what happens to my offspring. I do care about their future. I am not
right.
Like the wicked.
That's an interesting point also. Could be. Could be that that's what he means when he says, I don't think like they do. Maybe that's also a piece of it. It's a good point. Stephen.
Well, it comes down to what is success. So we're talking success. Is it materialism? Is it what you see in front of you at the moment? Or success, what future generations will reflect on you, what you taught your offspring? Is it materialism? No, it isn't. It's more than that. It's character. That's what we emphasize in Judaism. A good name. So these people, I see it, what Joel was saying.
Right. But keep in mind that his main purpose is not to condemn the wicked. His main purpose is to condemn God. He's not really concerned with condemning wicked people. Like that, he doesn't like them, but God is his target.
But we do have a right to question God and argue.
Well, that's part of what we're learning. That's part of what we're learning here, is the question, ultimately, with whom is God going to side? You know, is God going to side with the questioner, or is God going to side with his defenders? Job has, at this point, like, tripled down on the idea that God's going to side with him. But we have to see. We're getting there. Gradually. But that's the idea. Okay. That brings us to sentences 27 and 28, which will bring us back to an item that I held over from last week about the sota. So we're going to get to discuss this now. In sentences 27 and 28, he says, Hein yadati machshavo seichem. He says, I know what you're thinking. And when he says you, he means his visitors. I know your thoughts. Umizimos alai tachmosu. And I know the answers that you have, your plots that you have against me. Tachmosu is Hamas. Right? I know the Hamas you bring against me, which, you know, is a major allegation of wickedness against them. Kisomru aye veis nadiv. Hamas, if you remember from when we did Noach, is violence and violent theft. Kisomru aye veis nadiv. When you say, literally, where is the house of the prince, meaning where is the mansion, va'aye ohel mishkinos rishayim, and you say, where is the tent of the dwellings of the wicked, meaning, you say, if Job was really great, his house would still be standing. If Job was really righteous, God would not have collapsed the house on him and on his family. And so you are, once again, extrapolating guilt, assuming that I am terrible because bad things have happened to me, because what did he call it? Beis Nadiv, my princely house, or even my ohel, my tent, has collapsed. This goes back to, again, the point of trial by ordeal. The idea that if you're suffering, you must have earned it. So, last week, when I mentioned this, because it came up in chapter 20, this is not the first showing of this argument of when a person suffers, does that demonstrate that the person is guilty? We saw it back in chapter 16, sentences 7 and 8, was the last time Job says it. Job said, God crumples me, and people assume that means I'm guilty. We saw it so far, in fact, use it in chapter 20. So far said, you're suffering, you must be a bad person. And Job here again fights against it. So someone asked, well, isn't that like sota? Isn't the sota ritual trial by ordeal, assuming that if they're suffering, that's a sign of their guilt? So I think there are very important differences between sota and the classic trial by ordeal, and I thought it's worth it to take a couple of minutes to go through it. If you flip the page, source number 9, from that resource of all knowledge, Wikipedia. Trial by ordeal. It's largely borne out in various books. It's just a convenient place for which to cut and paste. Trial by ordeal was an ancient judicial practice by which the guilt or innocence of the accused was determined by subjecting them to an unpleasant, usually dangerous experience. Classically, the test was one of life or death, and the proof of innocence was survival. In some cases, the accused was considered innocent if they escaped injury, or if their injuries healed. Okay, so you put the person in a dangerous situation, a usually painful situation. If they get out, then they must be innocent. Usually, the case is involved either fire or water. Either throwing someone into, you mean by throwing them in the lion's den, that's a good example. Avram into the furnace is a good example of it, but it exists in much of the ancient world, and not just ancient, frankly, but exposing people to red-hot iron, throwing them in a river. Yeah?
Actually, I think it's the reverse. In Daniel and Avraham, they were thrown into the fire hoping they would roast. They did not, and that was proof of the protection of God. In the witch trials, where the floating test was performed, it was exactly the opposite, because if they survived, if they floated, it was proof they were a witch, and then they were punished.
Right.
If they sank, they were not a witch, but then they were dead anyway.
Right. The witch cases are a little bit different in that sense, but the overall trial by ordeal, which was far beyond identifying witchcraft, generally assumed if you survived, God must have taken care of you. That was the that was the way it worked. So let's turn to Sosa now. I gave you the reference on your sheets. It's Numbers chapter 6, 11 to 31. Jules. 340, thank you. In the stone Tanakh. Yes, while we're...
Also, in the Sosa case, the situation is not black and white. Because if she passed the test, then everything was fine. If she did not pass the test, she was ostracized. Before she was not really agreeing on whether she was going to be put to death. She was ostracized.
Well, she's never put to death. That's very clear in the sentence, is that no one's executing her. If she dies as a result of it, is unclear within the verses, will it actually result in death? But no one is actually laying a hand. This is whatever suffering she's going to have is going to be a result of what she drank.
It's with life and death.
Correct. But let's see the verses first, and then talk about it. So, looking at what you see here in sentences 11 to 31. Chapter 5. You're right. Unless you want to read about Nazir. Chapter 5. You are quite right. It's page 336, 337. Yeah, 5, 6. Yeah. There's wine involved in all stories. Yeah. Okay. So read it through yourselves. I'm not going to read it all out loud. You can see it for yourself. And tell me whether this sounds like trial by ordeal. Chapter 5, 11 to 31. Correct.
Starting with adultery.
That's the one. Hashem spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel, say to them, and so on. Did he handle it rashly? What's the procedure for him?
Yeah, ultimately, it's still patriarchal.
Right, but what's the... It's definitely patriarchal. I mean, for real reasons. There are reasons within a system why it has to be patriarchal.
Well, if she's proven innocent, she has to stay with him. So, in a bad marriage, obviously...
Well, she doesn't have to. I mean, divorce is always, divorce remains an option. In fact, if she wanted to, she could have avoided this whole thing by divorcing him. No one forces her to go through this ritual. She's the one who opts in, because she wants to stay. If you look from, one second. It's not, I have to admit, it's not explicit in the text. It's what the Talmud reads within the text. In other words, the text just describes what is done. It doesn't describe the option for it. But the Talmud reads it into the warnings that are given to her that she must have the opportunity to opt out or else the warnings don't make sense. So is this trial by... First of all, just to explain, we were talking about whether it's patriarchal. Why is it that this can only happen with a woman and you couldn't have a man be a... Sorry? Correct, because you have a system that allows for polygamy. Why does Judaism allow for polygamy? We've discussed this in other classes. Right, because God's first imperative to the world is procreate. in a marriage in which there is more than one husband and one wife, that means you've locked up all of your males for the period when she is pregnant and nursing. Whereas, if you have a system in which the man is able to have multiple wives, that means that theoretically you have multiple simultaneous pregnancies. So that's why the Torah does not prohibit polygamy. Mind you, it does its very best to discourage it by presenting us every single example of polygamy in Tanakh as being a disaster. There is not a single one that has a happy ending. But nonetheless, it's not going to prohibit it because it will maximize procreation. And it only becomes prohibited centuries after the close of Tanakh. But in terms of this story, since it's possible for a man to have more than one wife, you can't set this system up for the male. Because if you had a male who was alone with a woman who was not a married woman, he could just marry her. That's it. The case is over. There's nothing illegitimate about him having been alone with her. Whereas for the married woman, having been alone with another man is 100% of the time going to be a problem. So that's why you end up with this being male specific and therefore absolutely patriarchal.
Can you just again why the just
simple? It's about procreation. Right, but if you have a situation in which there are, let's say, two men and they're married to one woman, that means that for the period when she is pregnant and nursing, neither of them is going to create a new pregnancy. Whereas if you have one man with multiple wives, he can impregnate. Exactly. Sorry? Yes. Not to be coarse, but yes. Shana.
Physiologically, women are, so to speak, the bottleneck.
Yes.
But what I want to say is in terms of the ordeal, the ordeal really seems to be in two verses, when the Kohen threatens her in verse 21, and then in verse 27 when it's enacted.
Mm-hmm.
But the implication is not at all that she dies. It's clearly something very unpleasant. Mm-hmm. But she survives.
So it's really not clear. It's not, the verses do not state explicitly that she dies. This is true. But that's not what saves this from being trial by ordeal to me. I see three substantive differences between trial by ordeal and what's going on here. Can anyone see differences? Well, aside from the choice, because it just.
In verse 30, she doesn't have a choice.
In verse 30.
Her husband makes her go to the Kohen.
Right, so again, they understood from the fact that there are warnings that evidently she is able to choose. And Behemid, they will take as not that he must stand her up there, but this is, if they want to do this procedure, this is the way it is done. That's the way that the rabbis understood it. But here are the differences. Number one, trial by ordeal is where an allegation is made against somebody, and irrespective of prior history, we're now going to test by having them go through a certain ordeal. In this case, she is guilty already of a crime. If she's not, so that doesn't happen. You go back to the beginning of the story. The man, for whatever reason, and we can talk about whether this is a wise thing for him to do, the man gets it in his head that his wife is involved with his coworker or some guy or whatever it is. And he says to her,
Excuse me.
Yes.
He is, his suspicion.
Yep.
He's jealous.
Yes.
Aren't facts.
That's true. I didn't say that, though. Hang on. You're jumping the gun. Look at the verse. Hang on. The man becomes jealous, thinks that she has been involved with some guy, and now read verse 13, the middle of the verse. Vinistira vihinitma. The allegation is she was alone and something happened. In other words, she was alone with this man. There is a basic rule within Judaism. Married men and women are not allowed to be alone with somebody of the opposite gender. That goes both ways. Meaning that a married man is not allowed to be alone with a married woman, it's a prohibition for him, and it's vice versa. She's not allowed to be alone either with another man. In this case, what we're talking about is that the warning was given of, I think something's going on between you and Joe, and then she is alone with Joe. And you have witnesses that she is alone with Joe. You do not have, what it says, you do not have witnesses that a sexual act took place. If you had that, this would be a very different trial. What this is talking about is where she was alone with the guy. In other words, something wrong has been done. It may not be a capital crime, but something wrong has been done already. There's a bit of evidence here to start things off. That's number one. Number two is that the Sota case assumes innocence. Trial by ordeal assumes guilt. Meaning, in a trial by ordeal, you expose the person to harm, throw them in the river, put them in the fire, lion's den, whatever you like. We assume guilt, and then there may be a miracle that will save you if you're innocent. In this case, it's the opposite. We assume innocence of adultery, even though we know that she was alone with the guy. We assume she didn't do anything, and it would take a miracle to show that she is guilty. Because this water, all it has in it is the scroll that was erased into it, right? And yet, that's going to cause somebody to have their, whatever it is that's happening here, stomach bloating, whatever this is, shouldn't happen. It's the opposite. We're assuming innocence, and it would take a miracle for her to actually suffer something as a result. So that's the second major difference. The third major difference is that she's exposed to something benign. In the sense that what we are having her go through may be unpleasant. Well, not maybe. What we're having her go through is unpleasant. But it's not something that should cause harm at all. Not like throwing them in the river, throwing them in the fire, having them hold the hot iron pole or whatever else, the other examples that you would give. It's not trial by ordeal. In trial by ordeal, you have no prior evidence, you assume guilt, and you expose them to something harmful, and say, well, God will help you if you're really good. This is the opposite, in effect, of trial by ordeal. And that's, we didn't have time, and I wasn't prepared to have the conversation last week, so I cut it there. But I think it's an important thing to understand. The question then is, so what is this? Because this is radically different from the rest of the Torah. Normally, we don't deal with things in this way. This, you can't find an analogy to this anywhere else for any other crime. So a couple of thoughts are worth mentioning, just because we're running out of time. I'm gonna just throw out two points. One from a professor, Jacob Milgram, who suggests that this is to save her from honor killings. This is the Middle East, and it's not even, unfortunately, something that's that old. This is, newspapers today. But Milgram suggests that, realistically, if you didn't have a mechanism for dealing with this, you'd be talking about lynch mobs. You'd be talking about the family coming after her. And so this actually was a way to save her from that. That's one approach. But I prefer a different approach. Take a look, please, at source number 11 on your sheet. I thought this was fascinating when I saw this. The Code of Hammurabi. If a man bring a charge against one's wife, but she is not surprised with another man, meaning that we don't have any witnesses that she was alone with the guy, she must take an oath and then may return to her house. If the finger is pointed at a man's wife about another man, but she is not caught sleeping with the other man, so we have something substantive, but we didn't actually have witnesses to the act, she shall jump into the river for her husband. In other words, trial by ordeal, the genuine version. Jumping into the river means she goes into the river, and if she drowns, well, guess she was guilty. And if she doesn't, then I guess it's okay. Then I guess she can go back to her husband, a little bedraggled, perhaps. So what I see here is effectively a response to Hammurabi. It still has the water, right? She imbibes it rather than jumping into it, and we involve God in the equation by doing this at the temple with an offering and with God's name on the scroll. It's sort of a response, as I understand it, to what you see there. So that, to me, is what's going on. That's my polemic on Sota and trial by ordeal. There's more that could be said for sure. But just to sum up what we said, that was within Job. Because, you know, that's what we're learning. However slowly. He says the wicked thrive, they have children, things go wonderfully for them. When they disappear from the world, it's sudden. They have this, no pun intended, devil-may-care kind of approach to the world in which they don't need God. And they think that they're mighty. And don't tell me about wicked people who suffer, and don't call upon God to punish them, and don't tell me that it all works out in the end, and all, none of that. I'm not interested in any of those happy endings because I don't believe you. And finally, suffering is not proof of wickedness and his repudiation of the trial by ordeal. So next time what we have to do is conclude his speech to Tzofar and then start with Eliphaz. And Eliphaz is going to open our eyes because he's going to do something that nobody has done yet to Job. And we've all been waiting for this to happen. So if you want to look ahead, you can look ahead. But Eliphaz is going to do what I would have liked to have seen in the very first speech. So let's see where it goes. Thank you very much.